And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And clearly there's no mistake that when he says in the beginning that he's alluding to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, where it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if Christians know one Greek word, you probably know the word logos, which means word, of course. And that is the word that John uses when he says, in the beginning was the Word. Here he now alludes to someone, a person. He says he's in the beginning, and he describes him as being with God, and he is God. But why does he call him the Word? What could that word, what does that word bring to the John's, what does it bring to the minds of his listeners? Well, the word logos was used in Greek philosophy going back as early as the 6th century B.C. when Heraclitus wrote. He used the word in that sense, in a philosophical way. The Stoics later, in the 3rd century B.C. and on, they survived up until Marcus Aurelius was the last great Stoic philosopher, the Roman emperor. But the Stoics used the word in the sense of, they were pantheists, and they used it in the sense of the pantheistic energy, force, that was their concept of God. So the Greeks, the Gentiles, would have had this sense of, they would have understood when they heard the word logos, they would have brought that to it. They knew it was a religious word, but did they all read Heraclitus? Did they read the Stoics? Did they actually know what it meant? Because if you think of, I found out that, well, we have our word of the year, right? Turns out there's, I don't know how many, there's at least three or four words of the year, depending on whether it's Oxford or Merriam-Webster or dictionary.com. So, for example, in 2019, dictionary.com word of the year was existentialism. And in 2019, it's like everybody and his dog was having an existential crisis. But how many people using the word existential had read Kierkegaard or Sartre or Heidegger? Or did they have any idea what, did they even read the Wikipedia page on existentialism? I mean, we use that word, but it's a common word in our language, but do we know what it means philosophically? So in 2022, the Merriam-Webster word of the year was the gaslighting. Like, how many people who use that word have actually seen the movie or the play, which is it's a great classic movie, but we use these words in our common vernacular, but we don't know what all it brings to it. So the Greek would have heard logos, and he would have known it's a religious word, would have had probably some concept of pantheism or energy or force in the creation, but wouldn't have known exactly what Heraclitus or what the Stoics had wrote about it. But what about the Jews? How would the Jews have understood that when they hear the word logos? Well, you know, I don't know if you know, but Hebrew became a dead language for a while, and for hundreds of years, actually. And so by the first century and before that, when they would still read the Hebrew scriptures in the synagogue, but they would translate it on the fly. So they would have someone, they would read the Hebrew, and then they would translate it into Aramaic as the people were listening. Well, they finally started writing that down. It was all oral tradition. They started writing down, and those writings are called the Targums. And they're basically, it's a translation. It's a very loose translation. It's kind of like the Living Bible, probably, like a paraphrase. But turns out that they translate it, so they wouldn't say the name of God. We usually say it as Lord. And it's a four letters called the Tetragrammaton. Some people try to pronounce it Yahweh. Some people actually, I've heard, and I'm still on the fence about this, but some Christians have, scholars have advocated that probably we shouldn't even pronounce it, but that's another issue. But when they came across that word in the Hebrew text, they would translate oftentimes as Adonai, which is Lord, but over 300 times or hundreds of times in the Targums, they translated with the Aramaic word for word, which is mimra, so that when a Jewish person would hear logos, he would also have bring a little background to it as well. So that Leon Morris, quoting William Temple, says that the logos, alike for Jew and Gentile, represents the ruling fact of the universe and represents that fact as the self-expression of God. The Jew will remember that by the word of the Lord were the heavens made. And the Greek will think of the rational principle of which all natural laws are particular expressions. Both will agree that this logos is the starting point of all things. But now when you think, so now John's using a word, it's a loaded word, because the Greeks bring something to it, the Jews are going to bring something to it. And William Temple argues that, well, both are going to at least agree that this logos is the starting point of all things. So, but what is John doing when he now uses the word? Is he now drawing upon that? He draws upon Philo and the other philosophers that have used this word in different ways. Well, you think of Paul. When Paul's preaching on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, he saw a certain idol or monument, and it was to the unknown God. And so that was something that, well, they probably had a predetermined, preconceived idea of what that was. But Paul says, I'm going to tell you what it really is. Remember, as he says in verse 23 there, "For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." So he's going to set the record straight on what the unknown God is. He's going to tell them the real story about it. So you can think of John now uses this word logos, but he's now going to say, okay, you have an idea. There's this word logos. You've got, you know, it's a religious thing. You know, it's something that has something to do with the starting point of all things, whether it's pantheistic, permutating the creation or what, or whether the Jews think of it as the Lord himself or as the word that through which God made everything. Nonetheless, as John is going to say, this is what it really is. And this is the only place in the Bible, in the New Testament in particular, where logos, the word, is used to describe one of the persons of the Trinity. It's only in the first 18 verses of John's Gospel, which we call the prologue, because here in the prologue, he's going to give a summary of what he's going to talk about in the rest of the Gospel. So in this prologue, he now tells us what is the Word. He tells us that, of course, it's in the beginning, and they would have had that idea. The Word was in the beginning. But now he says, and well, by being in the beginning, it pre-existed. So it can't be part of the creation. It has to exist. He existed before the creation. So he can't be part of it. He has to transcend it when he creates it. He can't be a pantheistic word, as the Stoics would have had. So not only the word, and then he tells us the word was with God. Okay, so, and then he tells us the word was God. So it can't, so that's a little bit of a paradox there. It's, he is God, but he's with God at the same time. So it tells you there's something that, some persons, entities, he's going to go on to explain this, but we understand that there's personhood starts to come into play here, that they can be together and that they can be this relationship between them, that he's with God and he is God. Then he reiterates that he was in the beginning with God. Then he makes it plain, as if you didn't understand already, that he was before all things created. And then you might ask the question, well, okay, that, you know, they would have the idea, well, the word is, you know, as William Temple says, the starting point of all things. Well, how is that? Then he makes the point in verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So that's a very profound picture of the Word, this person, that he's with God, and he is God, and yet, and through him, all, everything that has come into being comes into being through him, and nothing exists apart from him. And that he is not only that, but he is the life. He has life in himself. Only God can have life in himself. No created thing can have life in itself. Life has to come from God. And that he, that life is light, and light shines in the darkness, which also reminds us of Genesis chapter 1. God said, let there be light. So this is that creative word. And, of course, the idea of using the word logos is that it's communicates. God speaks and things happen. They come into being, and he communicates, he reveals himself through the word. So that, with that background, then we come to look at verse 14 and on, where he now says, and this is the most startling thing that probably the Greeks could have heard with their preconceived ideas of what's the word. He says now, the word, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. When he says that the word became flesh, it's almost a shocking expression. We've heard it all of our lives, but if you could just take that out of your mind, imagine if you've never heard that before, and now you hear about the word, and you've heard the word about this logos all your life, and it's this pantheistic principle or force, and now you hear that it became flesh. You've always heard that, well, God and flesh is bad. God can't become flesh. He can't have anything to do with flesh in the creation. And so now he says, but the word became flesh. It's almost brutish, because you can think of all the ways you would have described how someone becomes a man, becomes human, but just to put it in the most fundamental expression possible, just to become flesh, or to become flesh and blood, as it said in another place. He became flesh, and so the fact that he becomes something, what does that mean? How do we understand that he became something? Normally we think of something changing to become, but when we hear the word became, we must not understand that he ceased to be what he was before. The divine person takes to himself something additional, something new, but he remains the same person. So he takes to himself something additional. He doesn't lose anything by becoming flesh. He becomes more by taking flesh to himself. He remains the same person. Notice he doesn't say he became a man, because if he said he became a man, you would ask the question, well, what kind of man? And if you were a Greek, you just have to put yourself back there. The gods had children. Hercules is the son of Zeus and his consort or wife. Is he a man like Hercules? Is he a superhuman? Is he a man and not a woman? So is it only men that he takes? So you can see, what's he trying to express when he says he became flesh? He didn't say he took to himself a body, because that opens up a whole other can of worms. Because if he just took to himself a body, well then, what if it's the Christ principle, the word, the logos, inhabiting a body with no soul? Or what if he just temporarily inhabits a body, and then he can lay it aside and go back to where he came from? These are all ideas that literally the church came into, were heresies that were fought out in the first centuries of the church, and were in the Greek mind. But what does he mean when he says he became flesh? It means he became man. He became human, truly human, in a universal sense, without regard to sex. So men and women are both included in humanity, without regard to race. There's no racial distinctions, Greeks and Jews. There's no regard to time. It's people of all time, from Adam to now, and the people that will be in the future. All of humanity. He took upon himself that humanity. He became flesh. Not a man, not a body, but flesh. The flesh of humans. He became that. The writer to the Hebrews says it, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil." The term flesh is unequivocal about the physical reality of his humanity. It describes his human nature with a view to its weakness, and its dependency, and its mortality. Flesh can be injured. Flesh can die. His mortality, his weakness, his dependence is all summed up in that. His human nature is so assumed that the two natures are now inseparable in the one person. And his human nature is retained following the death and resurrection. He didn't come temporarily and then lay aside the humanity and go back. He is forever, from now on, from then on, the God-man. Man and God, two natures in one person. He did not acquire personality when he took upon himself human flesh at the incarnation. He didn't take upon himself, he didn't become a person at that point. He was a person beforehand. The Greek idea, the pantheistic logos, has no personhood. But Jesus had personhood before the incarnation. He was not a principle or an energy as the pantheistic Stoics and Greeks might have understood. He was a person in the beginning, and as he had a divine nature, now is added to his person a human nature. Then he says that this Word who became flesh, he dwelt among us. He came and dwelt among us, and that reminds us of how when God took Israel out of Egypt, took them to Sinai and covenanted with them, he gave them the instructions on how, gave Moses the instructions for building the tabernacle. And God came down and dwelt in the midst of Israel in the tabernacle. Yet, there was still an immense distance between God and man. Moses was a mediator, but he could only represent one side. He was human. He could represent people to God, but who was going to reconcile the two between them? Moses couldn't do that. He could represent people, humans, but that was it. But the Word, the Logos, now joined to humanity, this is Emmanuel, God with us, a mediator who can represent both sides, being fully divine and fully human. He can now reconcile God and man because he represents both. He is both God and man. And we have seen his glory. Formerly, the glory of God was seen in the tabernacle. In Exodus 40, verses 34 and 35, he writes, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." When Israel, when they saw this, they saw visible glory. And they saw what else? They saw the works of God. They saw the miracles that he performed when he delivered them out of Egypt. They saw everything he did to the Egyptians. Not only that, they saw the miracles of how he provided for them in the wilderness. And then they would see the visible glory. So they saw his visible glory and the works that he did of deliverance and provision. But in Jesus, do we see visible glory? We don't. And you know, and John doesn't mention the transfiguration. Because if he had of, you might just limit your, we would limit our focus to that. We would say, oh, he saw it, yeah, on the mount. He saw Jesus' glory at the transfiguration. That's not what John is going to say. That's probably maybe a reason why he left out the transfiguration in his account. Because he's going to show us the glory of Christ throughout his life. In Jesus, there is no visible glory. And John doesn't mention the transfiguration. But in Jesus says, in verse 17, in chapter 17, verse 5, he says that he had glory with the Father before the world existed. And in 17, verse 24, he says he desires that his people be with him in the end to see his glory. Well, he had visible glory. I don't know who was there to see it. But he had glory before the creation, in the beginning. And we know that he says that when he, at the resurrection, after the ascension, he will return to the Father and he will have the glory that he had with him from before. But what about in between? How do we see his glory there? In chapter 12, verse 23, there's the account of Greeks came looking for Jesus. And that triggered something. When Jesus heard that, he said, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Why did that mean, when just because Greeks came seeking him, why did that mean that now the hour has come, and what does it mean for him to be glorified? Well, up to that point, he's been speaking to the house of Israel, to Jews. But now, the world has come seeking him. And what did he say about Moses lifting up the serpent? He said, when he is lifted up, he will what? Draw all men to himself. And at the Last Supper, after Judas had gone out to betray him, he said in 13:31, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him." So when the Greeks came seeking him, he said, "The hour has come." When Judas had gone out to betray him, when the betrayal, the crucifixion, the passion, the suffering is now set, there's nothing that's going to stop it, so to speak, he says, "Now he is glorified." How do we see the glory of God in Jesus? Well, we see it in his works. In chapter 2, verse 11, after he is the first sign that he did at the wedding feast at Cana, says after the miracle at the wedding in Cana where he changed water into wine, he says, "This, the first of the signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So in the past, God did works of deliverance and miracles. Now Jesus does signs that are miraculous, and his glory is seen in that. And when he raised Lazarus from the dead, he said, when Lazarus was sick, and they were saying he's sick, he's going to die, and Jesus said that the raising of Lazarus was so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So he would be glorified in raising Lazarus from the dead, performing that miracle. Now, if glory commonly refers to the revelation or manifestation of God's character or person, then what do we see of God's character in Jesus? In Exodus 33, when Moses asked to see God's glory, what was God's answer? He said, "I will make all my glory." No, you remember. He said, "I will make all of my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord." So then the Lord, later, when Moses was on the mountain, and he said, and God passed before him and said, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin." And then we see Jesus, who in the beginning was with God and was God, the one through whom all things are. He now becomes flesh and humbles himself to dwell among us. He lived a life of perfect obedience and submission, never seeking his own interests. He came to that hour when he was lifted up, suffering in the flesh, dying in the weakness of being human. In all of this, the goodness of God was revealed. The mercy and grace of God towards us was ultimately manifested in Jesus' death on the cross, because there he shows us favor and compassion in rescuing us from the wrath to come, because in the sacrifice of Christ, God was forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. He kept the steadfast love that he had promised to Abraham and David, and he was faithful to all of his promises. So we have seen his glory because we have seen God revealed in his life and his death. In his sufferings is where we see the glory of God revealed. What kind of glory is it? It's glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word now we see is something else. He's the Son. He's not just the Word with God. He's now the Son. We see the glory as of an only Son from the Father. The Word is the Son. He's the only Son. He's one of a kind. There are no other sons like him. Abraham had two sons. He had Ishmael and Isaac. Which one was his only son? In Hebrews chapter 11, it says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was an act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. Now, the fact that that same word is used there. So it's your only unique son, no other like him. Why is Isaac unique? Because he had the promises. Isaac is the only son in the sense that he is uniquely the object of God's favor and promises. So the glory we see in Jesus is of a faithful and obedient Son of God, of God the Father, who was with him, with the Father in the beginning. Grace and truth are seen in him because he reveals God to us, and God is characterized by grace and truth. So if God is revealed through Christ, do we see the glory of God as he reveals his character? Grace is the favor that God shows us in mercy and compassion. Truth is the knowledge of God and the faithfulness of God. These we see in Christ as he reveals God to us. Verse 15 tells us, he reiterates this now after having clarified some things about the Word, the Son. He now says that John bore witness about him, in case you're confusing now the Son and the Word, if you haven't kept it straight. He now wants to make sure that we understand that John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. So that the Son is the same one as the Word who was before John, before the creation in the beginning. After declaring that the Word is the one who became flesh and dwelt among us, John makes clear that we are still talking about the one who was in the beginning, and that in that he is preeminent with regard to John the Baptist. And then in verse 16 we see, for from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. As God, his fullness is without limit. He has grace without limit to provide to us. There's never-ending supply of grace that we receive from him. Some have pictured it as waves on the ocean, that the grace just follows grace. There's different ways to understand that. There's been debates about that preposition, but in some sense, there's this never-ending supply of grace. However it's pictured, that part is clear, that if we need grace, it's there for us, that Christ can provide it. And then he tells us that the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And this is introduced as a major theme, if it hadn't already been introduced in verse 1. Now a major theme in John's Gospel is introduced, namely that Jesus is superior to Moses. Now we have two mediators. Moses is human. Jesus is the Word, who took to himself humanity. And notice that the law is given through Moses, but grace and truth come. They came through Jesus Christ. Grace and truth are lived out, so to speak, in Christ. He shows us the grace and truth of God because he puts it into action. And his suffering, his humility, his obedience, his humble, lowly life, where he was willing to obey the Father to the point of death on the cross on our behalf, grace and truth are revealed through him. The law looked forward to Christ, and Christ fulfills the law. No one has ever seen God. No one has ever seen God. The only God was at the Father's side. He has made Him known. Flesh and blood cannot see God in His essential being. Many have seen what we call theophanies, or manifestations of God. Adam walked with God in the garden. Abraham walked and spoke with God as a friend when God revealed His intentions for Sodom and Gomorrah. Jacob wrestled with God and said, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." Moses spoke to God face to face, and Isaiah and Ezekiel saw glorious visions of God, but none of them saw God in His essential being. They can't, because He is spirit. But the Son is now called what? He's now the only God. That's that word again, only. The only unique. Why is it now combining? He's now, you would think He would say the only Son. And believe it or not, there are some manuscripts that say that. But generally believe that the best reading is the only God. So that the Son is now called the only God. This ties together two threads. The first one, that He is God in verse 1. The Word was God. And the second, that He is the only one of His kind. He's absolutely unique. The only God. He has proclaimed Him. This one is the Son. Since he is described as at the Father's side, and to be at His side describes a place of intimacy. The same word is used of the disciple John reclining against Jesus at the Last Supper. This one, this Son, who is at the Father's side, has made God known to us. He has explained Him, so to speak. When we look at the Son, we see the Father. When we look at His life of humility and sacrifice, we see the goodness of God. When we believe in Him and receive Him, He gives us the right to become children of God. He gives us Himself. He prayed for us, "Father, I desire that they also, whom You have given Me, may be with Me where I am, to see My glory that You have given Me, because You loved Me before the foundation of the world." Do you want to see that glory more than anything in this world? Do you want to see that glory? Then hear the words that Jesus said to Thomas, "Do not disbelieve, but believe." And say with Thomas, "My Lord and my God."